Okay, so Boaz is very, very old at this point. In fact, we will learn later on that Boaz just consummated the marriage with Ruth, and he died the same night. Boaz was married to Ruth exactly one day, less than 24 hours. And people say, oh, he died because he committed the sin of marrying the Moabite. But it's exactly the opposite. He should have died long before. God kept him alive until he was able to complete his mission on earth. And when that mission on earth was completed by the impregnation of that child, that would be the grandfather of David HaMelech, Boaz completed his mission in this world, and Hashem took him. And so we often misunderstand that it is not the pshat, you know, he died early. God kept him alive until that mission had to be accomplished. That was the mission, Kabbalistically, of redeeming the trapped sparks of holiness that Lot had taken from Abraham when he went to Sodom. Those sparks of holiness now have to be reunited into their source within the Jewish people, out of which will come the redemption and Mashiach. Tremendous, tremendous mission, which establishes the whole foundation of the redemption of the world. Came from there. Now, one of the things that the Perek Beis describes is a very important halachic institution, and that is, Rus says to Naomi, let me go out to the field. Right? What does she say? She doesn't mention to go to Boaz, by the way. Boaz doesn't... In other words, in terms of what contact does Boaz make with Naomi, the Megillah indicates nothing at all. As Pasuk Aleph says, there's this guy Boaz who's related. That's all. Pasuk Beis has nothing to do with Boaz. Ruth is now with Naomi. They have nothing to eat. There's no food. We'll discuss what happens to their field.
But he sent her to his field.
No, she does not send him to his field. Okay. She says... Now you have to read it carefully. She says, let me go into a field. Doesn't say Boaz's field. Let me go to the field and let me follow the harvesters. And Naomi says, go. It happens to be. She walks into Boaz's field. Naomi absolutely did not send her to Boaz's field. Now, just to explain the halakhic background of this, keep in mind that in Eretz Yisrael, in the harvesting process, there are three different gifts that are set aside to the poor. Three different matanas, they're called. One is peah. Peah is that you have to leave the corners of the field standing. Now, how much? Well, we say every day in davening, Elu devarim she'ein lahem shiur. Certain things do not have a minimum quantity, and one of them is ha'peah. So under Torah law, you could leave one stalk, that would be sufficient. But the chachamim, the rabbis, advocated that one should leave 1/60th. That's not truma, that's not to the kohen, this is to the poor. 1/60th of the field standing in order for the poor to be able to do it. Now, peah is leaving the harvest uncut. You leave it uncut. Now, it does say that if you designated the peah and then you harvested it, then you leave peah from the grain, and if you didn't leave it from the grain, you leave it from the flour. If you didn't leave it from the flour, you leave it from the bread. Eventually, you got to do it, but the preferable mitzvah of peah is to designate peah from standing grain that was unharvested. Now, you may ask a question, why don't we do peah today? Even in the land of Israel, you do not find even the most religious farmers leaving peah. Now remember, this is not the trumos and the masros that are separated later. We're talking about peah, standing grain. So it's brought down in the name of the Chazon Ish that there is a principle in the laws of peah that say that when the aniyim, when the general population of the poor, generally regard the peah as not worth their while to come, so it's considered to be ownerless. It's no longer the poor property, and people, you know, the owners can take it. So the Chazon Ish says, in this day and age, when you have easier ways of getting, you have welfare and you have other things, and you're stucca, most aniyim would not be willing, or not be that happy, to go into a field, harvest raw wheat, and thresh it, and grind it, and do everything else. Therefore, it's as if they renounce their claim ahead of time, which will allow the owners to take it. That's why you will find, as a practical matter, Peya is not left today. But that's Peya. Peya is one month on it. Now, Peya does not seem to be what is described here. No, Peya is for the seven... No, the Peya is for everything. Peya is for all fruit, all fruits and vegetables.
So yeah. Could you also say that there's a corn or a broccoli or anything where you could readily take it and eat it?
That is true. That is true. Peya would apply to vegetables. Yeah. So you're saying that since it's much easier, just the double logic. Yeah. Well, it's a good point. It's a good point.
It seems to be 10% instead.
Yeah, but no, it's not instead. Don't confuse this. I'll talk about this. The Peya is not instead of the 10% that you give. You got to get the 10% as well as the Peya. Those are two different things. It's a good question. I have to think about it. I mean, Chazon Ish says that generally, aniyim don't want to wander into fields.
On the outside.
It's in the outside corners of the field. It's in a field. Particularly if you're an urban owner, you know, you're going to drive up to a broccoli field or whatever. Yeah. Now that's one. That's one matana. Now the second matana is leket. Now leket, which seems to be what is described here, is that which falls from the gleaner. The gleaner is the harvester. As they harvest. Now again, if you imagine harvesting with a handheld sickle or scythe, so what you do is you grab a handful of grain, you cut it, and what often happens is some grain falls on the other side of the knife. And you cut it and something falls over. That which falls over at the time of the harvesting process, the leket, must be left for the poor, and you're not allowed to pick it up. But again, keep in mind, I'm not referring to what you drop when you're carrying away the grain. Many people have a wrong impression. They think that if I'm carrying a sheaf of grain and things fall down, I gotta let it stay there. That's not true. Leket is what falls from the sickle as you're cutting the grain. Now here is a very funny, but a very unusual halacha, which would make leket a difficult institution to enforce. And that is, if I'm cutting grain, and one stalk or two stalks fall from the cut, I must leave it to the poor. So it's two stalks per cut. If three stalks or more fall from the sickle, I don't have to leave the extra, meaning the aniyim only get. So keep in mind, it's very difficult business. So I'm an ani, I'm following harvester around. I only get two stalks of grain per wave of the knife. If three falls, I can. Now, of course, if I take three and he doesn't notice, I might get away with it, but I'm stealing, basically. In other words, I'm only allowed to take up two. Now, keep in mind, if you have a whole bunch of poor people following, and it's two stalks per cut, it's not each person gets two. In other words, two is the total that is leket. So you see, it's a very difficult thing. And we're going to see that one of the reasons that Boaz admires Ruth, her righteousness, is because he notices that she meticulously never takes more than two stalks per cut. Now, how does leket apply in modern harvesting machines, even if it would be done, which isn't done today, is very difficult to compute, because if you get two stalks per cut, well, cut with a sickle is a cut, right? A handful of grain gets cut with a sickle. What do you do when you have a massive combine that can harvest, you know, harvest 50, a swath of 50 or 100 feet, you only get two stalks of grain, or do you hypothesize how many handfuls that would be, and you get two stalks per handful, and is there leket anyway? It picks up everything. Well, probably something that falls from the blades, but it's difficult to even figure out how you would compute, the ratio of two in a situation like that. But that's leket. So leket is what is no share, what falls from the knife at the time of harvest. And there is leket by fruits and vegetables as well. And the analogy, once again, is what you harvest from the trees or whatever it is, what falls from that process would have a din of leket. Now the third is called shichicha. Shichicha is that which you forget. But that is a little bit of a later stage in the process. That's, you know, the way harvesters would work, I guess even today, if they harvest manually, like with the migrant labor, you harvest the row, and then you, if it's grain, you then bind it in sheaves, and you leave it at the end of a row, and then you harvest rows, 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 and sheaves, 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 and then at the end of the day, you go back and you pick up the sheaves. This is how it was done. Well, shichicha is if in the process of going back to pick up your sheaves, you left a sheaf behind because you forgot to pick it up. That must be left for the poor. If you then remember, oh, now again, I want to emphasize, that which you drop as you're carrying it away is not shichicha, because you didn't forget it, you just dropped it. Dropping is only lekeh. That's what's called. So just to get these things clear, peah is what you must intentionally leave in the corners of your field. Lekeh is what falls from the knife as it's cut. Shichicha are sheaves of grain that are forgotten when you try to collect them. Okay? These are three matanos that must be left for the poor in the land of Israel. And these are called matanos shebasada. These are matanos that are left in the fields. Now, after that, after you ingather your grain and you process it, then there are other things you have to do, right? You have to give 2% to a kohen. That's called truma. And then you give 10% to a levi. That is called the first maaser. And then in year 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the 7-year Shemitah cycle, you do a second maaser that you bring to Jerusalem and you eat. And in years 3 and 6, you give 10%. Instead of paying it to Yushalayim, you give 10% to the poor. That is called maaser ani. Okay, so lekeh, shichicha, and peah is every year. Truma is every year. Maaser rishon is every year. But the second maaser varies. Year 1, 2, 4, and 5, it's your own that you take to Yerushalayim. Year 3 and 6, it is given to the poor. Then comes the Shemitah year that we read about yesterday. Shemitah, of course, you're not allowed to plant, but things that grow wild are ownerless, meaning the things that grow in your apple tree, anybody can come in and take it. In other words, you can take it too for what you need, but you cannot stop other people from taking it. And Shemitah has a bonus that in the Shemitah year, there is no obligation to separate any tithes or trumos or masras because everybody has equal access to it. The kohen can come in and take it himself. That's the Shemitah year. And then after Shemitah, we begin the same cycle again. Right? So we the halakha is we operate with a 7-year agricultural cycle of the land of Israel.
Does Aniyim have any obligation to trumos or any kind of separation?
Absolutely.
I should say,
the rule is that leket, shichra, and peah do not require the ani to take off trumos and matras. That's right. Because they were considered to be ownerless. And that which is ownerless, when you then acquire it, you do not have to take off trumos and matras. Leket, shichra, and peah is pachur from trumos and matras for the same reason that Shemitah produce is pachur from trumos and matras, because it's free and accessible.
If it wasn't separated from the owner,
I mean, the halakha generally is, like Chazal say like this, the obligation to separate truma comes when you basically finish processing the grain. So the halakha is, if you gave an ani grain that was already processed because you didn't separate the payah early enough, you have to take off the trumas and masras. You have to give him a net. You can't give him produce that's already higher than trumas and masras. However, if the ani processed it after he acquired it from Hefker, he does not have to take off trumas and masras. As I say, though, leket, shichicha, and peah for a number of reasons, some of which aren't that understandable, tend not to be practiced today by anybody. Although it is recorded that there were, under the Vilna Gaon, I think there were some meticulous farmers that were still leaving that to the day. I'm not aware of anyone that does it today. However, the trumas and the matros very much are done today, and they have to be done. Have to be done today. Now, this year, as you know, this Rosh Hashanah is a Shemitah year. And so, in a sense, it makes it more difficult because of all the halachas of Shemitah, but it also means you don't have to worry about taking the trumas and the masros of produce.
But you know, now they hired Arabs to work on the field. They carry to them.
Well, this is the famous, psak going back to Rav Kook after World War I. The Jewish populations in Eretz Israel were facing mass starvation. People, died of starvation. Because of the Holocaust, we sometimes don't remember the devastation of World War I. It's like the the later tsaros make us forget the earlier tsaros, but the World War One, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, was a very, very devastating time. So Reb Cook developed the heter that if the land is sold to non-Jews, just like you sell your chametz to a non-Jew, agricultural activity would be allowed to be done on Shemitah. So we have this saw a picture of him. We have this Arab. He buys all the chametz in Israel on Pesach, and he buys all the land on Shemitah. One fellow who the rabbinic has been dealing with for many years, and this is called the Heter Mechira. But many, many Gedolim were very much against the institution of the Heter Mechira. They considered it to be an improper circumvention of the laws of Shemitah, and many religious Jews, perhaps most religious Jews in Israel, they do not rely on the Heter Mechira, and they will only get imported food. They will get food that is either imported, or there are techniques to let things grow wild. I mean, in other words, obviously it's not totally wild. How can you have a technique to let things grow wild? But there are various things which facilitate the wild growth of fruit and the like, and the religious farmers have taken advantage of hydroponics. It's still small scale, but that's being done as well. So it's really a combination of imports, it's a combination of pre-Shemitah planning and hydroponics. That is how we
do.
Yeah, now God says in the Torah, right, I'm going to give you enough. Yeah. Well, there are many, many stories. I tell you, there are stories of kibbutzim where one religious kibbutz wanted to keep Shemitah fully, and the other tried to use the sale to the non-Jew. And the kibbutz that tried to keep Shemitah fully was blessed with amazing harvest, and the other one didn't do very well. So there are actually many stories, even today, of those things happening.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so it's a little complicated, because only a kohen that is tahor, that is ritually pure, is allowed to eat the truma and the matzah. And today, because we don't have the red heifer, all of us are tameh, so truma is not given to a kohen. It is separated and destroyed. Similarly, the maser rishon, the truma is destroyed. The only thing that is actually distributed is the 10% to the poor. People are still poor today, even if they're tameh. So the maser ani is distributed to the poor. Everything else is separated and not distributed.
The
challah, right, exactly it. The truma is either burnt or destroyed. Now, that's why I want you to know, again, I mean, it's obvious, but one should be aware that in Eretz Yisrael, and fruit from Eretz Yisrael, has many more halachic problems than chutz la'aretz, because I could walk into any supermarket and buy an apple, but in Israel, I could not, because you have to take off trumas and masters, and that's why you have to be careful to buy fruits and vegetables that have that are under hashgacha, under supervision, will be assigned, or find out how to separate. I mean, it is possible. It's not that you can't do it, but you have to be aware of exactly how to do it. And with Shemitah, you'll have another problem next year. Actually, it won't be so much next year, because the Shemitah problem is the year after Shemitah, because that's when the Shemitah fruit reaches the market. But the problem of Shemitah will not be a Trumas and Masras problem. But it's a problem that if the fruit was produced in violation of the laws of Shemitah, you may not be allowed to eat it. And those who don't rely on the what's called the Heter Mechira would have all sorts of problems. So once again, if you have a reliable hashkacha, you know, they take all of that into account. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could that buy food?
Yeah, you should not. You should not, unless you know how to take off Trumas and Masras. That's correct.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Sometimes it says.
Yeah. And it'll say, but if it doesn't say, you don't have to assume it's Israeli, because Israeli will only be a small percentage of produce in the market. But when it says, you know, sometimes stores like to, they jab oranges because they want to, you know, they want to get their Jewish customers. Mm-hmm. But it's really the opposite. A religious Jew, unfortunately, unless they know how to take off Trumas and Masros, will have to avoid buying Israeli produce.
Is this a question of 12%?
Well, it's a little complicated. Unless you have a coin to redeem it, etc., you would have to take off closer to 25%. Well, because you have to take off truma, you have to take off the first tithe, you have to take off the second tithe, so it'll be 20%. Right? So you're talking about more than 20. Well, there's a special coin. It's not kind of a magic coin. It's just a coin that was already used to redeem Maser in Eretz Yisrael. It's already, there's a coin that was already used for it.
What do you find?
It's like the coin
you can get it. You can get it in Eretz Yisrael. So, you know, this is an issue. So, if you don't have a coin, you would have to take off over 20%.
Cut the apple in half.
You can do that.
Yeah,
you can
do that.
I mean, you can.
You can do that.
Because you have to know what to say. You can't just you can't just give away a quarter. You have to designate what the quarter is.
Is there a brush that's done with it?
Then you wrap it up in plastic. And you can throw it away.
Is there a bracha with them?
There is a bracha, but we would not make a bracha on exported produce because it's a suffix whether you do take it. In other words, it's not clear that you have to take it off.
Let's say the girls were there for their year or whatever. They have to, whenever they go out to do buy fruits or vegetables, they have to know to make the. I mean, they have to be careful about where they're buying and make the bracha themselves. I mean,
But again, you see, it's complicated. If you buy in a place that is not under any supervision at all, you have to make a bracha. If you buy from a place that's not such a reliable supervision, you have to take off. But you don't make a bracha because maybe they took off. Right? So there are doubts.
What is the bracha?
Asher kidishanu. It's in the siddur. Allah prashat trumas umasra. On the separation of trumas and umasra. Right, so that's something to be aware of. That you know, even buying an apple or an orange is a very big problem. Now, if you buy it from an Arab farm, you do not have to take off two Muslim masters.
Even if it's in Eretz Yisrael?
Even if it's in the land of Israel. Unless the Arab bought it from the Jew, which you can assume would be selling it that this is his own program. Well, it's not under supervision, or it is? If it's under supervision, they took it off. They took it off from the strawberries, they took it off. Rabbinical supervision is that they took off what you need to do. You don't have to worry about it. Well, you walk in, you know, in Israel everything has a certificate. And you'll walk in and it'll say, this is under the Rabbanut, this is under the Eda Kaleda. The major chains have a Rabbanut, but it'll say, it'll be a sign. Well, that's the whole issue. Many people don't like the Israelis as Rabbanut. Many do not consider it reliable for Trumas and Matras. You have to consult those people.
When you have a preponderance of herbs,
Right.
Then you can
just like people have questions about organizations here, people are questions about organizations there. I mean, you know, you should talk to people that you know in Eretz Yisrael about this. For example, the Rabbanut in Jerusalem and Yerushalayim is said to be more reliable than the Rabbanut in other cities, you know, so everything else. If you buy something from Israel, you'll sometimes see seven stamps on it. It's like seven different Rubin Hashkafas. Like imagine the OU, the OK, the Chokke, you have like all seven of them, certify it. So somebody told me, all you need is one that you believe in. One good one is enough, you know. But to satisfy every taste. Okay, but going back to this, so just to be sure you understand exactly, we're describing here the three matanos that the aniyim get in the fields. And that is leket, shichicha, and teya. Now, when Rus describes, I will follow the kotzrim, I will follow the harvesters, what is she describing? She's describing leket. As they cut, I will pick up. Now, this is a hard way to make a living. It's a hard way to make a living because you only get two stalks per cut, if you're honest. And it's hard because other people are following with you. Right? It's very, very difficult. Now, one of the questions the Mefarshim ask is, you know, gee, Boaz seems to be very, very distant from this whole situation. Number one, why should it be that Naomi and her daughter-in-law Rus, okay, Naomi's not going out herself, but why should it be that Rus is forced to get bread, get grain, by following the harvesters? If Boaz is a wealthy person, why doesn't Boaz help them out? And even when This is the remarkable. Well, Boaz didn't know they're back yet. Boaz,
yeah,
maybe Boaz didn't know. He's sitting Shiva, whatever it is. But even when Boaz finds out, because if you remember the story is Ruth wanders into a field, and lo and behold, by an amazing coincidence, that's not a coincidence, Hashem arranged it, by an amazing coincidence, it is Boaz's field, the relative of Naomi. And when Boaz finds out, oh, this is my relative, this is Ruth, this is the Darwa. So what does Boaz do magnanimously? He doesn't say, I'll take care of you. He says, my daughter, feel free to follow my harvesters here. Feel free. And he offers her a drink, he offers her lunch. But basically, he doesn't offer her support. He basically says, you continue to gather the grain. So one of the questions that the Mephoreshim talk about is, why is Boaz so uninvolved, at least in a material way, in trying to help them? And there are a number of possibilities here. One possibility is that the picture of Leket is somewhat different than we have it. Leket was considered to be a very dignified way, because in a sense you were working. In other words, instead of getting a handout, instead of somebody just giving you things, you in effect were working to get your grain. Now it doesn't say they were assisting in the harvesting, it doesn't indicate that, but the very fact that you have to, you know, run and follow gave a person a sense of working for their living, and therefore perhaps it was a question of Boaz not wanting to embarrass Naomi by allowing there to be a labor involved. Another possibility might be that Boaz does feel that Naomi perhaps is being punished for an Aveira, either because they left Eretz Yisrael, or because maybe Ruth, this Moabite woman, is a sinful marriage. Therefore, Boaz does not want to legitimate it. Remember, he may have the same misbelief as other people. And therefore, he allows her to take charity, or allows her to do leket, but does not want to be involved in supporting. Now, we will see, though, that eventually he is won over by seeing her righteousness and her modesty and her character that makes him realize that she's a very righteous person instead of the opportunist that perhaps he may have had as an initial impression. And perhaps this was Boaz's way, indirectly, of seeing whether she is sincere. Because after all, she married these rich people who came from Beis Lechem Yehuda. Now they come back to Eretz Yisrael, and now there's this rich guy that's their cousin that can, you know, support them. Perhaps he needs to withhold a little bit to see if indeed, even though she's being humiliated in some way, whether she still has this righteousness and commitment. Well, that's correct. He is offering her nothing that she can't do anyway. Although we will see that he did instruct the harvesters to give her favor. But that was kind of a secret thing. That was not anything. In other words, in terms of what he's reading. So again, you can see this is kind of a funny thing. What is she supposed to think? Here is Naomi's relative, and all he's offering me is the same thing that I could do anyway without his permission. I don't need his permission to be able to go in. You also see that there are issues of tzniyas here in the idea of leket. I mean, men and women are gathering together. But Chazal even make the point that the way Ruth picked up the grain was in a very, very modest way. She bent over in ways that were not revealing. And this was something that Boaz was, in fact, noticing. Because, again, not so much as Chazal say that because he was looking at women, per se, but he was noticing because he was genuinely confused and perturbed about this Moabite woman that Naomi brings back. And Moab is such a trace nation, a bad nation, an evil nation. The Torah doesn't want Jews to marry Moabites. And in a way, it's almost... that's unknown. And in a way, Boaz regards this as almost a chutzpah on Naomi's part, that she dare bring this back. So he's kind of watching her. And he gradually gets very, very astonished at the fact that even though he really insults her by saying, feel free to follow my harvesters. So it's kind of an insult, because, well, thanks a lot, you know, I could do that without your permission.
Yeah,
and yet, how she accepts it graciously, and how she's grateful for these smallest favors, the way she's honest in only picking up two, even though apparently a lot of other people were not so meticulous in that halacha, in her modesty, and not in the way she dressed, the way she poured herself. So he has what you would call cognitive dissonance, because on one hand, the image of Moab is this evil, selfish, ungrateful people. Remember, what is the thing? Moab did not want to give us food and water, and they were not grateful for what I brought them. Yet here he sees in this young woman all of the opposite traits of character. So Boaz is just curious. He's watching because he doesn't understand where she's coming from.
Talk about Judy's point about, yeah. Isn't it kind of hospitality he's offering, sense also the fact that he said, don't throw somebody else's food. We don't know how you'll be treated well, because mm-hmm. my children here. And that's, you know, what was the sort of hospitality?
It's a little bit of a half-coat. Meaning it all depends on one's attitude. If one's attitude is, I am grateful for whatever I get, and I'm really grateful that you recognized me and you offered me hospitality. On the other hand, you know, if you had a different type of personality, you could say, gee, you know, thanks for the water, you know. But the point is, Ritz's Mida is exactly the opposite. Ritz's Mida is a hakaras hatov for the smallest type of benefit that somebody can get. And again, the assumption here is not that Boaz, God forbid, is selfish, but Boaz is holding back because Boaz wants to see whether she's an opportunist, hoping to cash in, as it were, on Boaz's connections, or whether she is someone who genuinely wants to be a Jew. Well, yeah, we do. Ruth must have always been a righteous woman. I don't know about Ruth's spiritual background, but you know, Ruth was the daughter of the king of Moab. So Ruth was a princess. She was a queen. I think we have to assume she was always a righteous woman. But I don't know. I don't know any history of Ruth before the Book of Ruth. I would have to assume that she married a righteous woman. But it also seems, though, that there was not such a big difference in Ruth and Orpah. The image was not that, you know, Orpah was the bad twin and Ruth was the good twin. Presumably, they appeared to be very much the same. But in the course of time, the differences emerged. It's similar to what the Kutzker Rebbe has a very nice word. Kutzker Rebbe says that Nebuchadnezzar, in the Book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar sings a hymn of praise to God. So it says Nebuchadnezzar's hymns were so great, so wonderful, that it would have put David HaMelech's Tehillim to shame until a Malach came and slapped him on the lips so he couldn't say it anymore. So that's what he says. Well, that's not fair. If Nebuchadnezzar would have done a better job than David HaMelech, so why should he be shut up? So the Kutzker Rebbe says that's not the meaning of the Medrash. The meaning of the Medrash is that when Nebuchadnezzar was rich and powerful, he was so expansive and effusive in his praise of God, it looked so wonderful. But God said, the real test is, what does he do after he slept, after he suffers, after he's low? Does he still have that capacity for praise? David did. Nebuchadnezzar did not. In other words, it's not that God shut him up. It's that when Nebuchadnezzar suffered, he no longer had the ability to praise Hashem. And therefore, the difference between Ruth and Orpah is, in affluence, they both were more or less the same. The greatness of Ruth is how she responded to this adversity.
Just wondering, were concerns about Orpah and the everyday life, and taking the concept of
No, obviously it was intended. We'll discuss it when we get there. There was a deliberate reason. No, there was a deliberate reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted aspersions to be raised and to be re-raised again and again and again against David. There was a reason why it would always appear that David came from someone that was Tasa. And we'll see why. That was actually part of God's plan, that David should come out of a background that was very negative and very questionable, and whose kashrus was not at all certain. So just to look at the psukim again, so Rus the Moabite, and again it's important to note why it always says Rus the Moabia, because it wants to highlight the fact that she was a stranger, she was an alien. And she takes the, I mean, imagine this, as difficult as it might be for any poor person to wander into a field and start gathering, how does a person feel, you know, who's this Moabite, a hated person, a despised person? And she says, and she volunteers, and you can imagine that, you know, she might be so unwilling, but if Naomi says, go out and do it, well, I'll do it. Ruth initiates. She says, let me go out. Please let me go out. And Naomi says, go, my daughter. And she goes, and Vayikar Mikreha. There was a happenstance. In other words, it was not planned by them. And she walks into the field of Boaz. And Boaz comes from the city of Beis Lechem. It is said that this is the day of the funeral of his wife. Vayomer Lekotrin. And he says to the harvesters, Hashem Imachem. Now this is very important. The Mishnah in Brachos says that Boaz actually made a new takana at this point, a new halacha. And that is, when you greet people, you should greet people with the name of God. May God be with you. Now that's why we say, I actually mentioned Hashem's name. Hashem's name. And mentioning Hashem's name, even Hashem Imachem, is not taking the name of God in vain, because it is proper to bless people with the name of God. Now that's why we say Shalom Aleichem, peace be unto you, because Shalom is also the name of God. Now you'll notice, that's right, goodbye is the same thing. Now you'll notice, they responded back to him, Yivarechacha Hashem. They invert the order. May you be blessed by, may God bless you, so that's what we say, Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom, is based exactly on this pasuk, Hashem Imachem, although it's not exactly a parallel, Hashem Imachem, may God be with you, and they say, may God bless you. But Boaz was the one that enacted that a person should ask about his friend with the name of Hashem. And Boaz immediately says, who is this girl? To whom does this girl belong? Now again, Chazal say it's kind of an unusual question. You know, he walks in, he just buried his wife, he sees a young woman, he says, does this woman belong to anybody? But Chazal again points out that this is not a sexual thing or a physical attraction thing, but he is amazed at her modesty, in her dress, in her comportment, in her behavior. And the young man is full of all this information. He says, this is a Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the field of Moab, and she said, let me gather the sheaves, etc. And she was here from the morning until now, and she only rested a little bit. So now Boaz makes what we said was his not so magnanimous offer. Do not go to another field, go with me, because after all, you don't know how you'll be treated elsewhere, and you should stay with my narosai. In other words, stay with my women. Meaning, we don't know exactly how the mechitza works here, but apparently there were designated areas for women to follow and designated areas for men to follow. And he tells Ruth to stay with the women, etc. And then he offers her the ability to drink. You can drink the water that is drawn for my workers. And look how she responds to this. You know, you'd think it's not the greatest offer, but she falls on her face, she bows down, and she says to him, why have I found favor in your eyes to recognize me? Va'anochi nachriya. I am a stranger. I am a foreigner. I am an alien. And I'm so grateful. Again, it is very interesting that he offers her water. I didn't see this in the Medrash. Remember that the Moabites are condemned in the desert because they didn't offer us water, lechem and mayim. And he offers us, the Moabite, the lechem and the mayim, which she gratefully acknowledges. And now Boaz says, it has been told to me what you've done to your mother-in-law, etc. You have forsaken your father and mother, the land of your birth. And then we have the famous pasuk, Yishalem Hashem Paaleich. Hashem should repay you for your efforts, and your reward should be complete from Hashem, the God of Israel, who you have sought refuge under his wings. Alright, now then he offers her a second thing, and he says, during the meal, during the lunch meal, which was of course the main meal for the harvesters, you can come and join. Right? So he offers her two things. He offers her water. Well, he offers her three things. first thing is a little uncertain. The first thing he offers her is, stay with me, don't go to another field, and I have instructed the young men not to harass you. Now, it's not clear what harassment he's talking about. There are a few possibilities. One harassment is just the general rudeness that the harvesters might have to the poor people, saying, get out of here, don't bother me, get out of the way. The other might be sexual harassment, in which the young men... Nageha is like nega, often means affliction. So it either refers to, you know, the general rudeness that the harvesters might have, or it might refer to being sexually harassed or insulted. So that's the first thing he gives her. The second thing he gives her is water. And the third thing he gives her is the ability to enjoy the afternoon meal with the other people. Then there's a fourth thing that seems to be a private, uncommunicated thing, because Rus would not have taken advantage of this. And that is, Pasuk Tetzvav says, Vayitzav Boaz Esnarov Leymor, Boaz commands his harvesters, saying, Gam Bein Hamarim Tilakets, let her gather among the sheaves, below Tachlimuha, do not embarrass her. And the Pasuk says, deliberately drop some extra stuff. Meaning, say, drop some extra stuff right in front of her so she'll be able to take it. Now, again, you have to understand what that means. It can't mean drop more than the two because she wouldn't take that. But it must mean that even if you could cut everything and nothing would fall, deliberately cause a little extra drop. So here the concern is that, number one, she should have something. But number two, it was also designed not to embarrass her, that he doesn't want to, again, this seems to confirm that Boaz does not want to give her charity, but Boaz wants her to feel that she is getting the extra leket.
There are all these other people there. How are they going to guarantee, how does it work that she, if there's
well,
another pushes in front of her?
It's a little hard, but it could be like this, the workers, whatever worker positions himself that she's there, it could be the way it worked was, I don't know how many poor people there were and how many workers there were. I don't know if it was a one-to-one ratio. Remember, this is only Beis Lechem. This is not all of Eretz Yisrael. So it could be that each Anani tended to follow maybe a given worker. And therefore the worker that Rus was following was instructed to deliberately cut and cause to fall a little bit of extra stuff. And one point, though, Chazal do point out, you know, Rus comes back with a lot of food. Think about this. Think about how long you have to work to get significant amounts of luck.
She stays all day.
It's very, very difficult to work. You don't realize. Of course, even afterwards, what do you come home with? You come home with sheaves of grain. Now, you got to thresh it and everything else. Now, this was done before, though. What does the Pasuk say here? The Pasuk says, V'tachpot es asher liketa. She threshed what she had gathered, and she wound up at the end of the day with an epha of sa'orim. Now, let me just tell you how big an epha is. This is a phenomenal amount of grain. The amount of dough or flour from which you have to take off challah is a tenth of an epha. That's a tenth of an acre. That's the volume of 43 and a fifth eggs, which is anywhere between 2.5 and 5 pounds. That's why flour 2.5 pounds. You pick up flour without a bracha. It's machlokas. I don't compute it. Let's use the lower figure though. If 2.5 pounds of flour is a tenth of an acre, then an acre is 25 pounds. So she brought home between 25 pounds and 50 pounds, depending on the computation, of barley flour, or barley grain, after it was threshed. Remember, this excludes the chaff and everything else. So she gathered a phenomenal amount of grain, and it's very difficult to imagine how the leket process could give you that yield in a day. Now, it does indicate that perhaps there's another sentence. It says that when she ate lunch, by the tisbava tosar, she had leftovers. Maybe she took some leftovers from there too, but it seems that the bulk of what she took was from the leket. and she brought home an apron. So she's very successful. And Naomi is a little surprised, right? Naomi didn't expect such a good yield. And Naomi asks her right away, where did you gather? May the one who helped you be blessed. And Ruth does not know that Boaz is Naomi's relative. Well, this man is called Boaz, etc. And Naomi said, Baruch Hu Hashem, may he be blessed by God, who did not forsake his loving kindness both to those who are alive and to those who are dead, because of the merit of my husband and my son. And Naomi tells Ruth for the first time, he is our relative, he is our redeemer. We'll describe what that process is. And now, look at this though. Pasuk Kabbalah is the one negative note. Chazal has one negative comment about this. It's Michelle Esther, and they point out that, you know, as wonderful as she was, she could not quite forsake the Moabite background. It came out in a speech mannerism. What did she say? She says, Gan ki amar elai, the man told me, im hana'arim asher li tidbakin, that I should attach myself with the young men that are harvesting the grain. Now, if you remember, Boaz specifically said, attach yourself to the Narosai, to the young women. Where is the pasuk that's with before?
Narosai.
Yep. Right. He said, Ko, one second, no, Chet, no. Which pasuk?
Yes.
The Ko Tidbakin im Narosai. Now she paraphrases it, Im hana'arim asher li tidbakin. So Chazal points out that growing up in the promiscuous culture of Moab, she naturally talked in this particular way, which was not befitting even her own spiritual madrega. Her own spiritual behavior was very modest, very reticent, very tsanua, but she expressed herself in this way, even though that wasn't the way Boaz actually talked. So Chazal had one, that's the one little intimation that there's a little bit of Moabite that has not been totally eradicated yet. Okay. And we are told that she was continuing to do this. Of course, what does Pasuk Chof Gimel say? Batidbak benaros Boaz. What does that indicate? That it was only her manner of speaking that was a tiny bit improper. It was not her behavior. Her behavior was totally good.
Huh?
Right. And so Naomi corrects her. Naomi corrects her right away. But this is actually a very beautiful way of correcting. In other words, you see this idea that nobody makes a point of correcting. You just restate. In other words, now Ruth is very effusive and says, oh, I can go with the men every day. And Naomi says, it would be very nice that you'll go with the Naros. And the pasuk says, Ruth goes with the Naros. Right? So it's a very, very indirect way. That the book of Ruth is actually a very, very graceful book in the sense that everyone speaks to each other in a kind of a veiled, subtle way, but in a way that gets the message across. It's not a hard-hitting book in that particular way. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Lag BaOmer, because what we'll discuss next week is we will discuss Naomi's attempt to arrange, Naomi's successful attempt to arrange a marriage with Boaz, and why does she resort to a subterfuge and a hidden thing, and what is the role of Boaz as a goel, as a redeemer, and in particular, there are two redemptions that are going on. There is the redemption of Ruth to marry Ruth and to perpetuate the memory and the seed of Mahla, who died. And then there seems to be an economic issue of a field that Naomi has that needs to be purchased. We'll discuss, are those two things connected, or are those two different things? And what is the field? How does Naomi even have a field? Actually, it's a very good problem to think about this. If you think about the laws of inheritance in the Torah, when a man dies, his field goes to his sons, not to his wife. Now, if he doesn't have sons, it will go to his brothers. If he doesn't have brothers, it will go to his nephews, his brother's children. So the truth of the matter is, any field that Elimelech owns, when he died, would have gone to his sons. And if his sons are dead, it would go to Elimelech's brother, who is Salmon, And if Salmon was dead, it would go to Boaz. So the truth is, Boaz is already the owner of whatever field Elimelech owes to the laws of inheritance.
Okay.
What is it necessary for Boaz to purchase? Naomi would have no field at all. Now, the truth of the matter is, what a wife does have is, a wife is entitled to collect her kesuvah, and the kesuvah is collected from fields and real estate. So the only ownership that Naomi might have was a field that she collected from her husband's estate as part of her settlement as a kesuvah. That would be Naomi's rights. The question is, would Rus have any fields? So then the question becomes, that depends on the machlokas we discussed, whether Rus's marriage to Mahlon was a valid marriage or an invalid marriage. In other words, was Rus Jewish at the time or not Jewish? Now, if Rus was Jewish, then she would have a lien on Mahlon's field, the portion of Elimelech's inheritance. And the way it works is, Elimelech has a field, Elimelech dies, his field is divided between Mahlon and Chilion, and Naomi has her right to claim Exuva from the field, and then Rus would have a right to claim Exuva from the portion of the field that her husband inherits. Right? So we'll have to discuss the inheritance and the idea of redemption and everything else. We'll do that. We'll do that next week. Sorry, what time do you have for a little Lag BaOmer? Okay, yeah, so this will be a short thing of Lag BaOmer. You know, we know that this week is the 33rd day of the Omer, and we know that Lag BaOmer is a time of simcha, a time of joy. Some people stop the Avelis, the morning of the Omer period, from Lag BaOmer onwards. Other people resume it after Lag BaOmer, but everybody, virtually every minhag, on Lag BaOmer itself, we make weddings, we have haircuts, we can listen to music. Lag BaOmer is a time of great simcha. And there are two reasons why Lag BaOmer is a time of simcha, 33rd day of the Omer. One reason is that although the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died during the Sfiras HaOmer period, the 24,000 Talmidim, on Lag BaOmer they stopped dying. Now either they stopped and it didn't resume, or they stopped and it stopped. But either way, Lag BaOmer itself, the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, did not die. It was a hiatus in the Magepa. That is one reason why Lag BaOmer became a time of joy. The second reason why Lag BaOmer became a time of joy is that this was the day of the death of the Tana, Rav Shimon ben Yochai. Now, why would we celebrate? Because the day that he died, it is said, he revealed to his Talmidim the great secrets of Kabbalah, which are in the book of the Zohar, the great book of Kabbalah. And that day that his neshama left this earth, he revealed great Torah learning to the world, and therefore what is called the Hilula Derashbi. The Hilula is the celebration of the Petira of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, is a great simcha. You know, if you recall, he's buried in Meiron, which is right across the big hill across from Tzfat. And, you know, during the year, Meiron is a very sleepy little hamlet, you know, so you find, 10 yeshiva boys learning in the yeshiva of Meiron. But comes Lag BaOmer, you have hundreds of thousands of people. I was actually there last year, just very, very amazing.
You attended?
Yeah, it's one of those things you have to do at least once. I don't know, twice, but once you have to do. And I think I mentioned it. But anyway, I just want to mention two things about this. And that is, let's take these two perspectives of Lag BaOmer. You know, we say that every week of Sfira corresponds to a certain Midah of Hashem. We have seven Sfiras, seven ways that God interacts with the world. Midah number one is the Midah of Chesed, loving kindness. And Midah number two is the Midah of Gevurah, which is inner strength and discipline. Chesed is the giving impulse, and Gevurah is the restraining impulse. And when Chesed and Gevurah are synthesized properly, you have what is called Tiferes, which is beauty. Beauty is truth, because too much Chesed is destructive, and too much Gevurah is destructive. Right? If God would only give us Chesed, we would be overwhelmed and destroyed. Therefore, there needs to be a holding back. The divine light has to be held back. We don't always understand it. Too much divine light would destroy us. And yet, when there's no divine light in the world, there's only suffering. So the balance between Chesed and Gevurah is what is called Tiferes, which is beauty. Beauty is the harmonization of these opposite forces in the world. We also know Chesed is the Midah of Abraham, Gevura is the midah of Yitzchak, and the synthesis of Tiferes is the midah of Yaakov. So Tiferes has many terms. Tiferes is beauty. Tiferes is called emes, truth. And Tiferes is called rachamim. See, this is important. In the vocabulary of Kabbalah, rachamim and chesed are not synonyms. Chesed is the pure impulse to give. But giving in to the giving impulse is not always ultimately compassionate, because there needs to be that restraint and that discipline. So chesed is unbridled giving, but it becomes rachamim only when it's combined with gevura. Right? So rachamim and chesed we use as synonyms, but technically rachamim is the synthesis of the chesed and the gevura. And in fact, it's very nice because rachamim is related to rechem. Rechem is the womb. It is the love of a mother for a child. But a mother understands that the chesed must be circumscribed with gevura. Motherly love is rachamim, not chesed. Chesed is just giving, 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 without that sense of having to restrain. So each, well, now, then we go further, just to mention the other four. The fourth midah is netzach. Netzach is, different translations, eternity, victory, or endurance. And this refers to the notion, it's really a replay of the chesed. It is giving, like chesed, but it's a giving in the form of instruction and guidance. So when I give you rules and regulations, that is, which allows you to endure and survive and flourish, that is God giving us direction and structure. That is netzach. Hod, which is glory, is where there's an inner restraint to enable ourselves to shine. That's when God steps back to let our autonomy flourish. Right? So it's kind of a replay of chesed and gevurah. Netzach is burdening you with guidance. Hod is stepping back. Either of those are destructive by themselves. Yisod, foundation, is the reconciliation of netzach and hod, just like the Tiferes is the reconciliation of chesed and gevurah. And these are all the different things that God does, and when they're all mixed together in their proper proportions, it emerges in what is called malchus, the kingship of God, which is an empty vessel, which is simply the conduits for all of these mixtures. Now, in the vocabulary of Kabbalah, there is what you might call a very mechanistic view of the spiritual world, meaning it's like you're doing mitzvahs to push buttons to get these right mixes. Imagine you're an artist. So gevurah is red color, and chesed is white color, or blue, as the blue some say. So what you're doing is, if there's too much red, you gotta push a button to get more blue. So certain mitzvahs get you the blue. If there's too much blue, you need restraint, you need more red. So in Kabbalah, each mitzvah is very targeted to elicit the right balance in the world. That's why the concept of balance and harmony among the opposing conflicting forces in the spiritual universe is what you try to achieve. Because the Malchus reveals God's goodness in the world only when you get a harmony between the ideas of Chesed and Gevurah in Tiferes and these other balances. Okay, so this is the concept. So that's why sometimes in a Kabbalistic sense, it's like our mitzvot are like levers that manipulate a cosmic universe machinery of eliciting certain spiritual forces. God is responsive to the mitzvot that we do, to the kavanos that we have, to the Torah that we give, to the Torah that we learn, the tzedakah that we give. That we control this whole machinery. Now, so we have these seven. Now we know too that these seven sviros correlate to seven personalities. Avraham is chesed, Yitzchak is gevurah, Yaakov is tiferes, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, David. So every week of sviro corresponds to one of those elements, and every day in the sviro corresponds to that as well. So what's very significant here is that Lag BaOmer is the fifth day of the fifth week of the Omer. So that's our own and our own. Pose or pose. Now, the idea to keep in mind is this. The students of Rabbi Akiva died because they did not show proper cover to each other. Aaron's Mida is exactly the opposite. Aaron, who was a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace, saw in every human being their cover, their significance, their chashivas. So it's very important that on precisely on the day when Aaron's power is at its greatest, the influence in the world is one of shalom, always shalom, the road of shalom. The magepa disappears. Because the spiritual sin that brought that plague into existence gets eradicated by the influence of Aaron that we're capable of absorbing. So that would indicate, therefore, that on Lag BaOmer, the spiritual vibration in the air, so to speak, that you have to be open to, is to absorb the sense of seeing the kavod in another human being. That is the midah of Aaron HaKohen. It's Hod Shebahod. It's very, very significant. So that's the one element of Lag BaOmer, which is connected to the hiatus, the cessation of the death of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. And mystically, that is linked to the fact that Lag BaOmer is Hod Shebahod, the glory of the glory, which is the fifth day of... I only want my child to Torah, forget about everything else. So you look at it, you know, machlokas, right? Polo versus college, etc. But the problem with this Rav asks is, if you look in Maseches Erevin, Rabbi Nehurai and Rabbi Meir are the same person. Rabbi Nehurai is just Aramaic. Meir is to illuminate. Nehurai, they're the same person. He just has different names. Sometimes he goes by the Aramaic name. Sometimes the Hebrew name. So he's contradicting himself. He seems to be, you know, get a job, work. And then he says, forget about working. Just learn Torah. It's a contradiction. So the Brisker Rav says the following. There's really a machlokas in the Maseches Brachos between Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai on the verse in the Torah, the Asakta de Ganecha. The Torah says, if you keep the commandments, you will gather your grain. Rabbi Yishmael says, gather your grain. We see the Torah allows people to work for a living, meaning even though one is supposed to learn Torah, one is allowed to have parnasa. That's Rabbi Yishmael, right? Which we think is obvious. Rav Shimon ben Yochai disagrees with that. He says, what do you mean make a living? Make a living? A person's going to plant when it's time to plant, and harvest when it's time to harvest, and plow when it's time to plow. He's going to spend the whole day doing this stuff? How is he going to learn? How is he going to serve Hashem? And Rav Shimon ben Yochai said, you know, if the Jewish people would really be committed to serve Hashem properly, Hashem would take care of them. They wouldn't have to do any of this stuff. And the whole idea of parnassa is because the Jewish people are just not living a spiritually proper life. And the truth of the matter is, he could say this from his own experience, because if you recall, he spent 12 years in a cave, and for the running away from the Romans, and during those 12 years, the ravens brought in meat, I don't know what hashgacha, there's a plum like that, and the trees grew up with fruit, and there was water. So his attitude is to the world, it worked for me. Then why can't it work for you? Why can't you do it too? He actually said, he didn't see the legitimacy of parnassah. And Chazal say, actually, the Gemara says in Brachos, many people emulated the path of Rebbe Yishmael, where they worked for a living, and they merited a success, and they were successful. God gave them a bracha. And many people tried to follow the path of Rav Shimon ben Yochai, and they were not successful. They failed. They had to go out begging. They were not matzliach. So the Gemara seems to indicate that the path of Rebbe Yishmael is the normal path. But the Vilna Gaon makes an interesting deal. The Gemara condemns harbei asim. The many did, the masses did, the average people who tried to follow Rav Shimon ben Yochai's path, they were not matzliach, because for them that was not the path. But in every generation, there are yechidei segula. There are individuals who are so strong in their faith and so willing to sacrifice that Hashem expects upon them to take on the mantle of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. Now again, you might think, your first reaction probably is, gee, well, is this a debate about Kollel? Not necessarily, because a Kollel person will tell you, I'm not following Rav Shimon ben Yochai, I'm following Rabbi Yishmael, because I have signed up with an institution that will give me a paycheck. See, Rav Shimon ben Yochai is a very different thing. Rav Shimon ben Yochai is the person that says, I will devote myself to Torah, even though I don't know where my next check is coming. That's a very, very high level of emunah that only a few people in any generation So here's what the Brisker Rebbe says. So we now have a difference. For the average person, the proper midah is Rabbi Yishmael. For Yechidei Segula, special individuals, there is that midah of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. So now the Brisker Rebbe says, we can answer Rav Meir and Rav Mulon. Look at the difference in the words. The first statement of Rav Meir is a general teaching. The Yolam, Yolamei, Adam, Espino, Umnos, Nikia, the Pope. A father should instruct his child in a profession. That's a general teaching. The Rav Nehurai statement is a personal reflection on his own son. Eini, Molamei, Espini, Ella, Torah. Just as the Gemara says, the Harbe should follow the Mita of Rabbi Yishmael. The Yachid, the individual, may follow the Mita of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. That's how we reconcile the two statements. Now, the truth of the matter is, you know, we're approaching a Shemitah year. And if you think about what Shemitah meant, not so much today, because today we have imports and everything else, but at a time when everybody was in agriculture and there were no imports, Shemitah really meant putting your whole trust in God, not knowing where the next meal was coming from. God promises miraculously, you'll get it in the sixth year. But Shemitah was the great lesson in faith and trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shemitah, in effect, was the one time when all of Klal Yisrael lived on the level of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. In the Midbar, we did it for 40 years in straight. That's the month. Because what is the month? The month you get your bread one day at a time. You can't store it, you can't accumulate it, you can't plan for the future. It's very important. I mean, perhaps the most important thing about the man is you couldn't save it. Because that meant you have to depend totally on Hashem. You never had a sense on your own that I'm prepared for tomorrow. It was that total vulnerability that built up the emunah in Hashem. And that vulnerability was continued in the Shemitah year in Eretz Israel, where every seventh year we had to go through this. You could store it. Well, it wasn't quite as extreme, but still that notion of, you know, relying on what Hashem gave you in the sixth year as your emunah. You could store it. It was a little different. So in that sense, though, This was the Mida that Rav Shimon ben Yochai exemplified in his whole life. And we cannot be called upon necessarily to live by that Mida on a constant level. But there are times in our lives where we're supposed to experience it in order to give us that sense that we carry over into everyday life. So in a sense, if this was the greatness of Rav Shimon ben Yochai, it would appear that on Lag BaOmer is also a time to strengthen ourselves in that idea of Emunah in Hashem, in recognizing that everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that even though we operate with the illusion that our efforts are the key to our success, the money we have in the bank, the salary that we draw, we have to recognize that that is as much of a gift as the man that comes from the Shemayim. And therefore, these are the kind of the two ideas of Lag BaOmer connected to the two sources of joy. One is the cessation of the death of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim, which calls upon us to have that sense of kavod for each other, the Aron Aron. And the other is to take on, at least in small parts, the unquestionable emunah of Rav Shimon ben Yochai that will guide us. You know, emunah, you know, I saw a very cute cartoon. It was the two elephants coming off the ark, coming off the cave. And one elephant was saying to the other, you know, what a lousy vacation. It didn't stop raining for 40 days. This is a concept of the short-sightedness that we often bring to the world, where, you know, you can look at the world, if you look at life, and you can see a series of negatives. You know, why did this happen? Why did this happen? Without recognizing that there's in a larger picture, you know, God is giving us this life and this world and this opportunity. Just like, you know, they were saved from a destruction, and all they could see was that it was raining. So part of the emunah is to also be recognized that Hashem gives us these wondrous opportunities.
Yeah, but when 6 million died, some of the people, they stopped.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you. Well, you know, again, it's hard to know. I mean, getting together, people who get together like Homer are demonstrating friendship, obviously. So that's why it is one of the reasons why it's customary for people to get together. You know, the idea of the bows and the arrows, which historically was related to the fact that when the Akiva's Talmidim were learning and the Romans would catch them, they'd have to make believe they were doing something else. But the idea of getting together is very significant on Lag BaOmer. And in terms of emunah, well, that's always a question. How do you build emunah, right? And this is really a test every single day. But one should, you know, maybe enumerate the chassadim that Hashem has done for them and try to think about it and to give special gratitude even more than one would do generally.
You know, when 6 million died, some people just were very orthodox and they just stopped.
Well, listen, we can't, you know, we cannot judge someone that has gone through tremendous suffering. I mean, the Gemara says, Ein adam nitvas al sayro, a person cannot be blamed for what they do in suffering. So we can't judge. But the point is that a believer does believe that there's some ultimate purpose and plan in everything that God does, even though we're not aware of it. So this is Lag BaOmer, and if God willing, it should be a very special and important today, and hopefully we should be zocha to the great lights that Lag BaOmer brings into the world.
So we have a class next week?
Right.